8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Knotfest.com presents Talk to Me. With over 300 interviews under his belt and 6 years running, your host Joshua Toomey interviews metal and rock's heaviest hitters. Follow the show at Talk to Me Talk. Here's your host, Joshua Toomey.
What is up, everybody? Welcome into another episode of Talk to Me right here on Knotfest.com. As always, I am Joshua Toomey, and today my guest is Dino Cazares from Fear Factory. Dino is on to promote the Machine Head Tour that is called Slaughter the Mar Tour. So make sure you guys check your local venues, get some tickets when it's coming close, and go check out Machine Head and Fear Factory and Orbit Culture all under one roof, all on the same day. Now, we'll be honest, this was supposed to be a new pod episode, and this was not Roe's fault at all that he was not on the interview. When I sent him the calendar update, I sent him the wrong month. So I recorded this interview on January 11th. I sent Roe, hey, we're interviewing Dino February 11th. So after the interview, I looked at the text again. I'm like, why did Roe never show up? And I looked at the text, and I had sent him, let's start off the year big. Let's do an interview with Dino on February 11th. And I talked to him after I did the interview, and I'm like, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry it happened that way. He understood. We decided that this should not be a new pod episode, that I would just release it as a standalone Talk to Me episode. And it's been a minute. You know, I like doing these Talk to Me's occasionally, just me and a guest. And I haven't done an intro in a long time either. So nice to just finally get to talk to you, you know, while you're listening in your car, on your headphones. Do you work out listening to this? I have no idea what you people are doing. I did notice that I'm going into my 9th year of podcasting, which is wild to think. The 9-year anniversary of me starting Talk to Me coming up in a few months. And that's a wild time, man. Looking back, I just sent a photo of a screenshot of this interview to my friend. I just still sit back sometimes, and it is so wild to think of the guests that I've had on the show. And even Dino, man, I'm still wild after all these times to just get to talk to Dino Cazares for an hour and just pick his brain. And it's kind of like when he gets into the Dave Mustaine story in this podcast, where he's talking about how he would hook Dave Mustaine up with beer and sandwiches, and just get to pick his brain. And kind of what I do here, I just get to pick some of my hero's brain. So this is a fun interview. Actually, Milo pops on for about 10 minutes at the end. I had a kind of a question about Milo to Dino, and Dino's like, well, why don't you ask him yourself? So you get a nice little 10-minute interview with Milo towards the end of the episode. Very proud of this interview. Very cool interview. Make sure once again to go check out Slaughter the Mar Tour with Machine Head, Fear Factory, Orbit Culture, and Gates to Hell, coming to a town near you. Yeah, so make sure to check that out. Hey, if you guys want a Talk to Me t-shirt, make sure to head over to Depop. I've started a Depop. I got some other band shirts up there too, and some other things from around the house up there. So if you want to check out my Depop and order a Talk to Me shirt, I have 2X and I have 3X left, $15 each, and whatever shipping Depop charges you for those. The address is depop.com/talktome, all one word. So depop.com/talktome. Head over there, hit me with a follow, grab a t-shirt, got some Metallica stuff up there, some Megadeth, System of a Down, Slayer, Skid Row, Pantera shirts, Kiss shirts up there. So if you want to check out some of my band shirts, actually, if you check out some of these shirts, you might have seen them worn in interviews too. So interview-worn t-shirts from Talk to Me. depop.com/talktome, all one word. And with that being said, let's check out some Fear Factory. Let's talk to Dino Cazares, and I will talk to you guys momentarily. Disruptor! Uh, I was joking with Tony Campos, like one of the first times I ever interviewed him. I'm like, dude, leave some of the bands for us, you know, like stop snaking all the bands, bro.
You know, it's not just about being, it's not just about being a great bass player.
Right.
It's also about being professional.
Oh, I know. Not the most talented dudes out there get the most gigs. It's, are you reliable?
Do personalities,
reliable, you know, exactly. Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
knowing your place. I mean, it's kind of, some people might take this as insulting, but mm-hmm. it's kind of like knowing your place, yeah. knowing your position, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That you're a hired gun and you don't get in band in the, you don't get involved in the band drama, the band politics, the finances, certain like that. You're right. just hired to play. And yeah. some musicians and actually some fans, they automatically think that that guy is in the band.
Right. But
really, he's in the live touring band, but maybe not so much the, performing on the records and stuff like that.
Yeah, it gets into that wild area of dudes that have been in bands for years and years and years, and you just assume they're in the band, and they've been a hired gun this entire time.
The classic one is the drummer from Billy Joel.
Yeah, I watched that documentary. Yeah,
yeah, that documentary. Yeah, exactly. There's no, it's, you know, some people don't realize that this is a business. It's a mm-hmm. job. It's a job. You hire somebody to do a job, right?
Yeah.
And then sometimes people want to change their jobs. Sometimes people want to, you know, go to another, this quote unquote, go to another band and play another band because they're offering more money.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then the fans are like, oh man, what happened to that bass player? He was in the band for 10 years. He was so good. What happened to him? Oh my God. It's like, he's just a hired musician. Guys change their jobs all the time. People forget that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think there's just so much romanticism around four teenagers in a garage starting a band, all for one for all kind of thing. And once you get kind of past that initial phase, people start getting out of the band, or this guy goes off to start a family, and then you got new guys coming in. It's tough for people to really look that there's, you know, there's the guy in the band that's the leader, and then there's the, you know, what do you want to call them? Like pawns or something like that. You know, the rest of the guys are just kind of along for the ride, you know?
But yeah. And there's always going to be that one guy who's going to be the main guy, right. the main songwriter, the main guy who does all the business, you know? But you know, yeah, some people, you're right. Some people romanticize four guys, you know, growing up in high school or whatever, junior high school, they're all getting together and start a band. That's a thing of the past. I mean, right. there might be a handful of bands out there that are like that, but the majority are hired musicians or people have come and gone in bands. And it's just, that's just the way it is.
Yeah, it's still wild to me when I interview people and they talk about still getting in a room and hashing out songs and writing at the rehearsal space and things like that. Like that's such an archaic way to think nowadays, because now it's so much, you know, file sharing and I'll send you my parts and, oh, our bass player lives in New Zealand, so I got to get him his parts and things like that. So it's wild how, you know, back in the day, if you didn't go to the same guitar center or the same guitar store and see the same bulletin board that said guitarist needed, like you weren't going to get in a band. You could be one town over and still not know about that person. But now it's like the world and the internet and everything has brought everybody so close.
So a long time ago, back in the 80s, 85 or so, I used to work at a Sango shop. I was an 18-year-old kid working in a Sango shop. Dave Mustaine walks in. I knew who he was. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow. It was like, you know, I was freaking out meeting him. And I gave him free food. I gave him free sandwiches and I gave him free alcohol. Nice. And I figured if I give him this free stuff, maybe I could pick his brain and ask him some questions. And so if he's still sitting there, I would take a break and I would go ask him a bunch of questions. I was kind of like being fanboying out.
Right? Oh, yeah.
But really, I was trying to figure out how to break into the music industry, because I was just fresh off the boat, straight. I was from a small town, a place called El Central, California, which is like 3 hours outside of LA. And came here, got my first job at a sandwich shop. Met Dave and I said, how the fuck do I start a band? Right. And he told me make connections. And so it was really, that was one of the main things he said. He said a bunch of stuff, but that was one of the main things that I really used it to my advantage. It was this, goes try to find like-minded people, try to find guys you connect with, try to find people who are serious and want to do this for a living, blah, 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 but make connections. Mm-hmm. And so it was really kind of funny because he actually invited me to a show.
Oh, wow.
And he brought me backstage and he introduced me to people. And that's pretty much how I started meeting people. And there was a thing called the Music Connection, which is a, which was a free newspaper here.
Right.
That you can get back in the, we're talking like 1985. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that was the only way I could like, you know, see ads for people looking for musicians. And I started auditioning for other bands in that thing. But nobody wanted to hire me because I was either too young or my style was too different. So that was when I realized, okay, I need to start my own thing. And that's pretty much what I did. I started my own bands. I started going to shows, started, you know, seeing all the metal shows and just started meeting people. And that's pretty much how I met Raymond and Burton to start Fear Factory and other bands like Brujeria and stuff like that.
In those auditions, anyone of note or any musicians of note that you you would have played with back then?
No, there was just like local bands. One of them was called Tormentor. They said I was too melodic.
Okay.
They were kind of more really fast, speed metal, borderline grindcore-ish, early grindcore-ish. They said I was too melodic. There was another band. They were called the Four Horsemen. They were on American Recordings, which was Def, which was Rick Rubin's label. They were called, it was Def Jam, turned Def American, and then it went to American Recordings. And there was a band called the Four Horsemen. And I was, you know, 18 years old. They gave me a cassette. I learned the songs. They were like a, Danzig meets AC/DC, which was at that time, which was what Rick Rubin was really doing a lot. Cause he did Danzig, which was very dry, you know, very, you know, basic stuff. And then you had the Cult. He did a Cult record, which is very AC/DC. And so I can see why, Rick Rubin wanted to sign this band. But I auditioned for them. And actually, I didn't even make the audition. You know, they gave me the cassette. I learned it. I called them back like 3 hours later because it was so easy. Basic AC/DC stuff, right? I called them 3 hours later and I said, okay, I'm ready to audition. I got it. I didn't really know how to the process. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I called them up. They're like, we just spoke to you. I go, I know. I got it down. They go, how old are you? And I go, I'm 18. They go, oh man, you're too young, kid. Hung up on me. I was too young.
I was wondering if you might have came off too arrogant or something. Like, you know, I don't know how.
I was gung-ho. I was excited. Right. Yeah, I got it. You know, it's like, they were like surprised that I got it that quick, and I was like, but this is, you know, I grew up learning AC/DC songs. You know what I mean?
So right.
It was nothing. No new territory for me.
I was like the story of kind of the Fear Factory sound kind of, I heard you say it one time, you were listening to the outro to One and you're like, let's write music like that. You know, with the starts and the stops. What else were you kind of listening to back starting Fear Factory?
Oh, well, you know, obviously when I was a kid, we had a very big family. There was 10 of us all together, including my parents. And everybody liked something different. My father was into mariachi music. My mother was into rock and roll, Elvis Presley, Beatles. My one brother was into country and punk rock. Weird. So it was like Sex Pistols, Clash, and then Eddie Money and stuff like that.
Right.
Johnny Cash, yeah. But, you know, my sisters and one of my brothers was into Journey and Scorpions and like Frank Zappa, you know.
Okay.
And my sister was into like Elton John and Pink Floyd. And it's just, it's just all varied, you know what I mean, from different stuff. And so I grew up with a melting pot of music. And I liked a little bit of everything.
Right.
It wasn't until I heard, because back then Scorpions wasn't exactly metal. They were still rock, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when I heard like AC/DC and Sabbath, I mean, AC/DC is still rock, but AC/DC and Sabbath was really what opened the door for me. I'm like, okay, that's some heavy shit. And then, you know, by the time 81, 82 came along, you know, obviously getting into the early Judas Priest and Iron Maidens and Metallica's and Motley Crue's and stuff like that. And I just really, it just really grew from there. And of course, it progressively got heavier and heavier.
Right.
But I was also a fan of other stuff too. Mm-hmm. I mean, New Wave, Gary Numan, stuff like that. Really into 80s New Wave a lot. I dated a girl in high school that was really into the New Wave stuff. And so she exposed me to a lot more stuff.
You're also kind of credited with the term new metal, the new coming from, they've kind of related it back to New Breed, Obviously the Fear Factory track. Talk a little bit about kind of that term new metal and kind of being associated with kind of the genesis of the term.
Well, in England, they noticed that there was a lot of new bands coming out. You know, obviously Fear Factory, Machine Head, of course, Korn back 94, 95, 96, when they really started to hit out there in the UK. A lot of new bands were coming out. Obviously, Cold Chamber, 94, 95, Spine Shank. There was this whole new movement coming from LA. And at that time, we had a hit record called Demanufacture. It really blew up in the UK. And they took the song. They used to be called the New Wave of British Heavy Metal.
Right.
Remember that? That came from the 80s, mm-hmm. early 80s, New Wave of British Heavy Metal. And then they were saying a new wave of metal. And then when they heard the song from Fear Factory called New Breed, they started using that term, the new breed of heavy metal.
Right.
And then they decided to shorten it and just calling it new metal. That's pretty much how it came about. That's right. How they described all the bands that were coming out of LA at that time in the mid to late 90s. And then it just kind of grew from there. And the new metal term just kind of was exposed and it was out there. And then it just became an actual thing.
I was going to ask you, kind of growing up in the LA area for you, obviously the late 80s, the thrash and all the heavy stuff. And then there was that weird lull in the late 80s, early 90s of just kind of the clubs kind of being a little bit more empty than normal and things like that. But there was a lot of funk metal going on and a lot of just metal at that time was kind of awkward in that 92, 93 era. And then obviously you start getting, bands like Korn coming up and Cold Chamber starting, like you're talking about, obviously Fear Factory hitting, things like that. Probably kind of like that weird period kind of in between like the glam era into the new metal era.
Well, you could definitely thank Nirvana for killing all that. Because I mean, it literally was gone overnight. Right. You know what I mean? The minute Nirvana hit the airwaves, radio, MTV, boom, they completely changed their format. You know, a lot of people who were not there at that time, who didn't see the music scene
mm-hmm.
happen at that time, they might not be able to fathom it because they were probably too young at that time, but it literally changed overnight. It changed the landscape of music. And we were right in the middle of all that. But, but there was other stuff that was big. It not only killed glam metal, it also made thrash metal dormant. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I'm not going to say thrash metal was completely gone, but some bands were actually still trying to put out records. But a lot of people were trying to change their sound. Because if you look at, Metallica, Load and Reload, those were, they were even trying to change their look and their sound. They were even trying to go, more alternative, you know what I mean? And it just, there was this weird period where that I literally seen one scene die and another scene fucking become huge, which I was into as well. I love that stuff. All that early sub pop stuff. You know, Amphetamine Reptiles was another record company as well. Like putting out the first Helmet records, heavy. Me and my friend Henry from Butcher Babies, he's a guitar player. We were just going on about early Helmet before they broke. It was heavy stuff. And also me and Burton used to go to all these shows. Early Nirvana, when they were playing like small punk rock shows, we were going to see Nirvana shows. You got to realize that LA at that time to me was from when I got here in 1985 all the way up to 1995. There was a good 10 years of just new things cropping up, things changing, and just seeing it all. You know, bands like Ministry doing industrial metal, or, you know, early Nine Inch Nails, you know, the first record, seeing them tour on this first record, and they were not that big, playing small clubs. The whole industrial scene coming up, you know, Skinny Puppy put out a record called Dude Too Dark Park that got really big. You know what I mean? All that early stuff. And I was just like me and Burton were like sponges and just going to every show and just falling in love with everything because we just appreciated everything. So early Sonic Youth, Mudhoney. I mean, I could keep going on. Pixies. Even the goth scene was massive out here. You know what I mean? Early Cure with Disintegration record. Fucking amazing record. Love that. Going to see them play. You know, we were just absorbing everything. And that, you know, of course, metal was in my heart, noise in my blood. But I love so much other stuff. And just seeing all that stuff was amazing. And, I mean, we would go to everything. I mean, we would go to fucking Fields of the Nephilim. I don't know if you guys ever even heard of that band.
I don't know that one. Yeah.
It's like spaghetti Western goth.
Okay.
you know, Sisters of Mercy shows. You know, I'm trying to think of every band. Diamond Nogales. Diamond Nogales was a girl who just had a bunch of different effects, and she screamed on microphone and just doing crazy shit.
Yeah.
We would just go to everything, you know, and we loved it. And I just love that era of music because new things were coming out and other things were disappearing. And it's kind of funny how, things come in cycles. You know what I mean?
So, oh, yeah.
You know, the whole, obviously, you know, people are saying new metal's back. You know, there's some bands who never disappeared. Right. There's some bands during that time period of like after 95 and going forward, there's some bands that didn't disappear. Like Korn was one of those bands that sustained that level all those years. You know what I mean? Whereas like Limp Bizkit kind of started, got really huge, disappeared for a little while, then came back. You know, there's been a few bands like that. And kind of like us, I guess you could say.
Right.
For us, it wasn't because of a music scene. It was because lawsuits and band member changes.
Yeah, there always does seem to be something going on at the Fear Factory camp.
So, also another thing too that was really cropping up was the early, you know, death metal and grindcore scene. That thing was coming up, like from the mid '80s to the early '90s when it's reached its peak. You know, bands like Morbid Angel and Napalm Death and Carcass being like big at that time. You know what I mean? I remember one time there was at the Hollywood Palladium, which is like 4,000 people here in Los Angeles. It was one show. I think it was Sepultura was headlining and a few other bands playing at the Hollywood, sold out. Right. And then down the street was Cannibal Corpse and a bunch of other bands. That was sold out. I mean, that was like, that was like 10,000 people at two different shows.
Wow.
And it was amazing. It was massive back then. It was a great time to be around at that time because it was new and exciting and it was fun. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's just how it was, you know, going to the best example was like early Lollapaloozas, the beginning of the first Lollapaloozas. We had Susie and the Banshees, Ministry and Rage Against the Machine and Ice-T with his Body Count and, all the times, you got to see early Soundgarden and stuff like that, you know?
Man, there's a video of like the second ever Rage Against the Machine show, and they're playing like a park, and they're already a well-oiled machine. It's insane how good that band was, like right out the gates.
Yeah, I think some of the members were in another band called Lockup or something like that.
Yeah,
not to be confused with the grindcore band Lockup.
Right. Yeah, that's one of those names. You know, talking about, you know, the sound change of Nirvana and things like that. Like, I remember I would have been 12 in 91, but like still I knew I was listening to something different because my cousins were big into, you know, Cinderella and Guns N' Roses and Poison and Motley Crue and all that. And I was into that too, because that was what they were playing. And I really wanted to be in a band, but I was like, I'm not wearing eyeliner and tights and, you know, things like that. I was just like, that's not right. So I saw, you know, you start to see Smells Like Teen Spirit and the first Pearl Jam 10 and just knowing something is different sounding and like, oh, you don't have to look like a woman to play in a band. You can actually just go out in what you're normally wearing.
Well, everybody dropped the makeup and the hairspray. Yeah. They went to flannels and you know, Doc Martens.
Right.
You know what I mean? And ripped up jeans and, you know, it's cut off jean shorts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was a big thing. I mean, our old singer Burton worked at a place called Nana's, which was kind of like the fashion for grunge okay. fashion store, right? And they had every color of Docs at the time, burgundy, blue, black, you know, white, whatever. And he worked there, and every day he would be bringing, here you go, here's some new Doc Martens. And we were wearing the shorter cut,
mm-hmm.
like the mid Doc Martens, not the tall ones or the
right.
short ones. It was like the mid ones. And so if you go back to early Fear Factory shows, you'll see us wearing those free Doc Martens that he got us. That was kind of our look. I just had a pair of sweatpants
mm-hmm.
that I would cut into shorts.
Okay.
Because that was the look kind of back
mm-hmm.
then. You just got some pants, you cut them into shorts, and you wore some like thermal underwear that would go from your ankles.
Right, right. Yeah. Oh yeah. The thermal underwear, that's the look right there. Yeah.
That was the look and the flannel. And so we were a cross between that look and metal shirts.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to some of the old pictures, you'll see our jeans cut or whatever we had, sweatpants cut. And that was kind of the look. And so we were a cross between those two things.
Talking about things coming back around again, my stepson is 16, and for Christmas this year, he asked for a pair of JNCOs. I was just like, you've got to be kidding me. And like, we bought him a pair of JNCOs, and he is wearing the hell out of them. You know, I was just like, and I feel older now because that's, you know, I never could afford JNCOs back in the day, but always wore big baggy clothes. And then now I understand why my parents were like, why don't you wear something that fits? You'll look nicer. And I always just want to be like, you know, you're so handsome, put on some clothes that fit, you know?
Yeah. We were explaining that to Milo yesterday, our new singer. He's from Italy. So he saw some of that, but he didn't know how extreme it was because there were some pretty big pants. they look like Clydesdales, you know what I mean? Like, you know,
then it starts to rain and you got half a soaked leg of rain all over the place. And
yes, and I see that some of them were longer and then people were stepping on them. Then there was like strings of material from your jeans. And
oh, it was a wild time.
Yeah, it's coming back. And I think it's fun. I think it's
That's
cool.
crazy.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely talking about like the new metal era kind of being a dirty word there for a while. Like even when I went from playing in notable new metal bands and like I would try to get in audition for another band and be like, you know, telling people that I was in a new metal band. It's just like, all right, well, we'll try. Yeah. But that's not something to put on the resume. And now it's like, dude, you played in Primer 55, man. That's crazy. You know, like people hit me up all the time on Facebook and stuff.
I always laugh about people like, oh, Fear Factory was on this record, Digimortal.
Yeah.
I guess you could hear some of the new metal elements. Mm-hmm. Right. But I always laugh that's what they call the new metal record in some ways.
Right.
But if you really look at it, it's, if you go back to our very first record, there's a song called Scapegoat. Gang. And it's very much like Corn Blind, mm-hmm. but just 2 years prior to that.
Yeah.
Or 3 years prior to that. And it's like, I feel like we've always had that groove element, that nu metal groove element in our music from day one, before it was even a thing.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, definitely that song is kind of come under some scrutiny over the years. Like, did Ross slip them that tape early, or did they really write the riff, you know, without knowing? You know, you got to wonder what happened there.
Yeah, supposedly that Korn was in, I guess they had another band called Sex Art or whatever, or some, I don't know, one of the other, there's another guy who's credited for writing that.
Right.
He was not in Korn, but he was in one of their other bands mm-hmm. that they had. And I've recently ran into that guy. I don't remember his name, but he was trying to tell me that he wrote that 1993. And I said, well, I still got you beat.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So, but yeah, now that guy's making money off that song. And I think it's pretty funny.
That's crazy.
You know, but then you take that riff, and then you apply it to Cold Chamber. Mm-hmm. This is the way it's got to be. They sped it up. And then even Slayer has that similar riff. I think I want to say Diablos and Musica.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what song, but it's there. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like, people always get mad at me when I say, hey, look, these, like, a certain groove or a certain riff can like go, you know, could I call it, they could travel to other songs,
yeah.
and keep going and going and going, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's just one of those riffs. And I was really into Helmet,
mm-hmm.
and Helmet had a riff similar to that. And I was like, fuck yeah. And this, I literally wrote that song after going to see a Helmet show in 1991.
There you go.
Me and Burton went to go see Helmet. We came back. I was like, fuck, I got a riff. You know, just the inspiration of being so excited seeing that Helmet show going, and because they had grooves, man. Back then they had grooves, heavy grooves.
That's funny too. You know, you're talking about you kind of really wanting to write songs similar to the outro to One, but then when you get down into it, then it's you know, the outro to One is really just Darkness Descends by Dark Angel.
Yes. I mean, you could say, I don't know if Lars was listening to Dark Angel and took it from there. I don't know.
Right.
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 But it definitely, the production on the Metallica record was miles ahead of the production on that. On that Dark Angel record. So, but the Dark Angel riff goes, so the riff's different, right. but the drum pattern was the same. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But Metallica just focused in on that one particular drum beat, with the guitars being exactly syncopated to what they were playing,
yeah.
with the stop-start thing. And I was just always like, why can't they do more of that? I was always, you know, really yearning for that from Metallica, and they just never really got into it further than that. And I was like, man. So, you know, a few years later, that was 1988.
Mm-hmm.
So by 1990, I was like, okay, now that I got the drummer Raymond who could play that kind of stuff on the kick drums, I'm like, okay, we're going to write these kind of riffs and write this kind of stuff. And that's pretty much that one little piece of Metallica is what inspired me to do pretty much almost every song in Fear Factory, where the kick drums follow the guitar,
which is their Fear Factory sound, which in a weird like turn of events, then, you know, Gene Hoagland joins the band, you know, years later. And it's just like this entire, you know, butterfly effect of the entire world or something, you know?
Yeah. It's funny, 'cause I didn't even know about that story till after he was out of the band,
mm-hmm.
you know, he started talking about it in interviews, and that's how I found out. Like, he didn't say anything to me when he was in the band about it.
Somebody working on the HVAC in my house.
Oh, good.
I was like, all right. So I don't know how
some industrial sounds go on.
Yeah, right. It actually works out. And like, you might write a new song after this interview.
like, but it's really kind of funny, you know, being a musician, how certain noises mm-hmm. can inspire you, because
yeah,
you think rhythmically, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like every time I'm driving, I turn my left or right signal on, my turn signal. I'm like, dun, 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 dun. You think riffs, you know what I mean? You think,
right.
It's sometimes it just drives you crazy. You hear something like some machine or just whatever, mm-hmm. and you're thinking rhythmically, and it's just like, get it out of my head, you know.
Now, there was always a joke going around of, do you remember those old dot matrix printers where it's like, they would print out like a line at a time, and everybody would joke, just like, that's how Meshuggah writes their music. It's just, like, just listen.
Yeah.
Or they would just listen to old Fear Factory and find riffs there too. just talk a little bit about the early days of Ross Robinson and kind of technically, you know, kind of being one of the earliest bands that he really worked with and what he became.
Yeah. Well, I met Ross back in the mid, I don't remember exactly what year, but we were both very young. We were still mm-hmm. very young. And Ross used to play in a band called Detente, which was a band, I want to say 86, 85, 86. And so I would go to the rehearsals. You know, I was not in any band at the time. So I would go to the rehearsals, and he was a guitar player. You know, he had that Randy Rhoads Jackson. He had that Marshall, you know what I mean? And so mm-hmm. he had all the cool pedals, all the cool stuff. And he was just really into that band. His band, and then something happened with the band, broke up. They started another band called Murder Car, and with Dave McLean on drums.
Oh wow,
with Dave McLean from, he was in Machine Head and also he's in Sacred Reich.
Yeah.
So for those people who don't know, we all became roommates. All three of us were roommates: me, Ross, and Dave McLean in Hollywood. And I started a band called the Douche Lords, which was like, a ripoff of SOB meets the Mentors. And so we did our first demo with Ross Robinson. And so that's when he started getting into production side. And he learned from a guy named Dana Strum. If I'm not mistaken, it's Dana Strum. That he learned how to do production.
Really? Yeah. Wow.
I think he's not. Dana Strum is in Slaughter. I think he's also in Vince Neil's band.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's one of those guys that was producing rock bands back in the day. And I think Ross learned a lot from him. And also, we were working out of Blackie Lawless's studio. Blackie Lawless from Wasp. He had a studio called Cherokee Studios.
Okay.
And yeah, in Hollywood. So we were doing our demos out of there, Fear Factory demos. So we were doing them out of there. Of course, you know, he did our first record that never came out called Concrete. And I used Ross Robinson's Granny Rhoads Flying V, tuned down to B. Tuned down, yeah.
Right. And
it was really, it had a floating bridge. So we had to figure out how to keep that bridge from floating, because when you're tuning down lower, you know, the bridge is going to drop. So I remember having to figure out how to do all that. And it was great. We figured it out, and it sounded killer at that record. And, you know, we had other songs that we didn't even get to record. One of them was Scapegoat. You know, Ross knew every one of our songs. He was at our rehearsals. He, you know, came down and, you know, gave us a few pointers and things like that. Or just, you know, he was like one of my best friends at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we were really close. I mean, we did everything together. You name it. Everything. And not sex, but I'm just saying everything else we did together.
Right.
So he was kind of like a little bit of one of my early mentors as well. You know, just, because he had all the cool stuff, but he didn't have my right hand. That was the one thing. And so he really liked that. And he really saw that Fear Factory was going to do something great. And so he really wanted to, you know, be our official producer and so on. And but things didn't work out. But we did record an album quality demo.
Right.
And it was called Concrete, which came out many years later. But he would use that demo. I had a cassette. He had a cassette. Obviously he had the reel-to-reel tapes, because back mm-hmm. then you recorded on tape, right? So he shopped it around to try to get to produce other bands. So he shopped that demo, you know, saying, hey, he would go to other bands and say, hey, I can get you this production. This is what I've done recently. You know what I mean? And we were using the demo to shop to record companies. And so record companies, everybody turned us down. Even Roadrunner at first turned us down. It wasn't until Max Cavalera from Sepultura, who heard the demo, actually, you know, saw Monty and told Monty Connor at Roadrunner Records, you need to sign these guys, right? But before that, us and Ross got into a legal dispute because we didn't want to sign his contract, because he mm-hmm. gave us this pretty extensive contract and we didn't want to sign it. And the lawyer said, if you sign that contract, you're not going to own anything. You're not going to own your songs, your publishing, the recordings. You own nothing. So we're like, maybe we better not sign this. So things didn't work out. We ended up splitting ways with Ross Robinson. We kind of fell off friendship-wise after that. And then, so like I said, we were able to shop the demo.
Yeah.
We just couldn't release those recordings. Neither could Ross. Ross couldn't release the recordings either. So we took a bad thing and made it into a good thing. And we eventually got signed, and Ross ended up, you know, a couple years later signing, or 3 years later, getting Korn on a production deal. And then boom, you know, obviously he blew up, the band blew up, we blew up on D-Manufacture. So, you know, it all worked out good. And now we're friends again.
That's good. How deep into the Fear Factory catalog were you guys recording on tape?
I'm trying to remember if we recorded on tape on Obsolete. I don't think we did. No. Okay. It was definitely Soul of a New Machine and D-Manufacture.
Okay. And just kind of over the years, I was thinking about this listening to Aggression Continuum the other day, just like how the recording process has changed so much to where what you're doing back then is kind of what people are doing now with the you know, the matching the kicks and just being so precise. Like, that's the one thing, you know, D-Manufacturing all those old records, like, they're just so precise. And like, and back then, obviously recording to tape would have had to have been a task, to where now it's kind of like you could just line it up if you mess up.
Yeah, a lot of people you know, thought that D-Manufacture was a drum machine.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And that, like, no, we just, me and Raymond just really focused, me and Raymond, the drummer, mm-hmm. we just really focused on being tight as fuck, trying to be syncopated and being tight. And we rehearsed, you know, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. You know what I mean? Every day we were, me and him, if nobody went, you know, a lot of times nobody else was around. It's just me and him jamming, just getting music down, getting tight until we, just when we recorded the record, it was just spot on.
Whatever happened to Raymond? Do you talk to him at all?
I haven't talked to Raymond in a little bit. Not recently. I just know he's working on his other companies. That's about it.
Well, let's get onto the Slaughter the Mar tour with Machine Head, man. What's your history with Rob and Machine Head?
Oh, Rob was at one of our first shows. The first time we toured America, mm-hmm. we opened up for Biohazard and Sick of It All.
Wow.
And it was 1993, Soul of a New Machine. And Rob had heard about my Marshall. I had this Marshall head, and it was modified.
Okay.
And it just had this particular tone. And Rob had heard about it. And actually came out to our show in 1993 when we played San Francisco, and you know, we met. That's when we first met. He was like, "Dude, I heard about this head. I gotta fucking hear it live." Blah blah blah. And he was just going on about my tone, and he was really into it. That was 1993, and of course, I think 94 was the first Machine Head record came out. Mm-hmm. But I believe he ended up using the original 5150 with a tube screamer. I think that's what he used on that record. But yeah, it was, you know, we both came up in the scene together. You know what I mean? Obviously, he was started many years before me with Violence, mm-hmm. you know, and probably some other bands that he was in. But yeah, you know, we just became friends ever since 1993. I mean, that's 30 years.
So that's the one thing that's getting me, you know, when the Black Album turned 30, I was like, all right, that was, you know, my major introduction to metal was the Black Album, but it's still like, that was not my youth or whatever. But like this year is like kind of like a lot of these 30-year-old milestones, like Burn My Eyes and all that are going to hit 30 years to this year. And I'm like, man, that is just too much.
Yeah. I got some friends in the music industry that I've known since I was I'm not going to say a kid, but mm-hmm. in my late teens, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like Ross That's Robinson, mm-hmm. Ross Robinson. I mean, I met like every grindcore death metal band way yeah. back in 90, from 1990 to 19, you know, from 89, actually going back to, well, even before that. Wow. I met Dave Mustaine back in 1985. You know, it's like I've met these guys many years ago, you know, many, many years ago.
Yeah, I was standing near Dave Mustaine at the recent Louder Than Life in the media tent. I was doing stuff with Knotfest, and just standing near him. I mean, I met him in the 90s, I think, but like I haven't really been around him since then. And it's still just like, that's fucking Hangar 18 right there, you know? Like you're just like yeah. still freaking out that just being in the presence of the man.
I had a really good friend. Her name was Nancy Focox, and she used to be my roommate, and she mm-hmm. knew everybody. She was actually from the Bay Area, and she knew everybody and all the bands and all the Bay Area bands. So I met a lot of people through her as well. That's the first time I met James Hetfield. You know, he was in my apartment.
Oh wow!
Drinking Jägermeister. It was just like they were mixing and Justice for All.
Turning the bass down.
That's when I met him.
Yeah. Were you the one? Did you hear like a rough mix? And you're like, you know, there's too much bass.
No, he was very closed and secretive to that. Yeah. But I also, from there, I met Jim Martin from Faith No More.
Yeah,
and I met the rest of the guys in Faith No More through him. And so Jim Martin was a guitar player in yeah. Faith No More, and yeah, I met a lot of people from that whole era of music. But even before that, before I met her, I met all the guys in Testament, Exodus, you know, back in the early, in the mid 80s when I first got here, because my sister knew the owner at the time of Golden Voice. Okay. Golden Voice is a very huge company now. They do Coachella. But back then, they were doing punk and metal shows. And so I, through my sister, who knew the owner of Golden Voice, production company, promotion company, whatever you want to call them. I met them. So they got me free passes to all the thrash shows back in the mm-hmm. day. So I got to meet all those guys way back in the day. I see pictures where I look like a young little kid. You know, I was a little kid meeting all the guys in Testament, Exodus, and all those guys. And just, I got old pictures of all that stuff. And it was cool. I didn't only just get to play the music. I got to meet the guys in the music, and I didn't right. get, not just to be, you know, somebody who just standing in the crowd watching the shows, but that was also part of my networking, if you know what I mean.
Oh yeah. To steal a Josta term, were you ever a Punisher to any of these people? Do you look back and go like, ooh, I probably, laid it on a little too thick there.
No. I think because I learned early on, like not to be that way, because I worked in a sandwich shop right next to all the production studios in Hollywood, like television and movie production companies, right? And I saw famous people come in every day, right? And I mean, you name it, all the different soap stars, the different, you know, television shows, you know, all the guys in Motley Crue, Quiet Riot, you know, Dawkins, all the early, you know, kind of glam metal bands, right? Rat, they all come in there because there was also a recording studio down the street too. So whenever anybody wanted sandwiches or burritos, there was a burrito place next door to our place. So people would always come. There was a lot of traffic from those studios coming over. And so I got to meet those people. I just knew how to be cool. I just figured it out, not to punish them. Plus our boss of the owner of the sandwich place also told us, don't bother them. You know what I mean? And so I learned early on just to be cool. You know, it's kind of funny. You're taking their sandwich order, and then maybe I'll ask them a question. You know
right. I mean? Slip in a too fast for love question or something.
Yeah. Hey, man, I love that record. I love that song. Well, like, hey, cool. There you go. You know what I mean? They're like, hey, thanks. You know, they would think it was cool, and they would come in all the time.
I've heard obviously the Mustaine story a few times. Was there anyone else that came in that you kind of picked their brain too, of giving them a free sandwich or some beer here and there and got to pick their brain too?
No, I think Dave Mustaine was the only one because I was really into, you know, the Metallica record, you know, the Metallica records.
Yeah.
So I was really into that. That was the only one that really blew me away. I mean, of course, there were beautiful actresses that would walk in there too. And I mean, of course, you know, right. I'm an 18-year-old kid. I'm like, what's up? You know what I mean? But they were not going to take me seriously. I'm fucking making a sandwich. You know what I mean? With my hair tied back.
Right.
In one of those like early nets.
Oh, you know, nice.
Yeah.
That's a good look.
And here I'm making a sandwich or something. So they didn't really take me seriously. But, you know, I met, like I said, I met everybody in Motley Crue and Quiet, all those bands. I loved all those bands and all the guitar players, but I would never really, you know, ask them too many questions or stuff like that. I never really bothered them. I just let them know that I know who they were.
Right. Just as we kind of wrap up, man, how is the band, you know, how are you enjoying this kind of iteration of Fear Factory, new singer and all?
Well, I think we have a very, very, very killer lineup at the moment. Everybody in the band is just firing on all cylinders. Pete Weber he comes from a thrash metal band called Havoc. He's an amazing fucking drummer. He fucking rips it up. And it's really kind of cool because he not only plays everything to the T, but he also adds new fills or new little double bass things in there, which kind of makes the song, kind of breathes new life into the song as well. And of course, Milo, you know, he's pretty much hitting every note every night. He's definitely learned a lot, you know, doing 120 shows that we've played so far. So, yeah. Everybody's firing all cylinders. We have Tony Campos on bass. Of course, right. You know that he's a veteran just like me. but when he's doing Static X, like for instance, on this Machine tour, he's only going to be doing the first few shows. Then he's got to go and link up with Static X and Seven Dust. He's doing that tour. But when he does that, our bass and guitar tech, Javier Arriaga, fills in for Tony while he's gone.
Nice. Yeah. Have you seen a change in Milo?
What kind of change are you talking about?
No. I was going to say, have you seen a change like in him from the beginning of the band? Now he's kind of 120 shows in or whatever you were saying. Like, you know, are you seeing a different guy out there or, you know, just even just day to day?
Oh, 100%. 100%. Yeah. You know, when he first came out, he was excited, like running everywhere. Then he realized, it was like, wait a minute, I need to conserve my energy and, you know, concentrate more on. I wanted him to concentrate more on working the crowd, his banter, which he's got down really well. You know, banter, like talking in between songs and getting the crowd hyped up, things like that, and not just being like some crazy wild man on stage.
Like I enjoy the enthusiasm, but just calm it down.
I mean, It just in that way, because, you know, because when you're having to do that style, we're doing aggressive and then melodic, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of the, you're using a lot of breath, you're using a lot of, you know, breathing techniques. And so he pretty much learned not to when to go crazy and not to go crazy.
Right. I mean, he also, sounds killer, man.
So, also feeling very comfortable on stage. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that, you know, he was extremely nervous, but, you know, he definitely was nervous. I'm sure. I mean, we all still kind of get nervous. I mean, it's natural. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I get nervous for him or Pete or Tony or Javier. I get nervous about the show. Is mm-hmm. the show going to go well? You know what I mean? That's what I get nervous about. I don't get nervous like, am I going to fuck up? Oh my God, there's a lot of people here. I don't get nervous about that. I get nervous about, you know, is everybody going to do well?
Right.
You know what I mean? Where I know when he first came out, he was definitely nervous as hell.
Well, I would think
that ask him, he's right here.
Well, I was gonna sure. Let's go ahead.
You know, hey, what's up?
What's going on, man? How you doing?
What's going on? Great. Just woke up.
Living the yesterday. Dream. Yeah.
Just landed yesterday in LA, and it's been a long trip as always, but fighting with the jet lag as always, but you know.
No, I actually just asked Dino. I was asking how you have you know, your entire time in Fear Factory, how much have you changed from the time that you first joined the band to where you are now in the band?
I think it changed a lot, like Dino was saying. Like, I feel like I was thinking just today, I feel like a different person, you know. it's that big of a change, I think. I think I was a different person before the first tour, then I became another different person after the first tour, and another mm-hmm. different person after the second tour, and so on and so on. So I think it's the change is that big, you know. It really changes you completely, not just musically and as far as being like a good frontman goes, but also like as a person, you know. It's that crazy because this is a huge life change, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, how much touring had you done prior to Fear Factory?
How much what
touring had you done prior to Fear Factory?
Almost none. Okay. I mean, that was my first touring experience, you know. I've been playing professionally for more than 20 years as a drummer, more than 15 as a singer, and of course in that that's because of my family, which is both my dad and my mom are professional musicians. They've been working in the music industry, mostly Italian music industry, and playing. Like, my dad's a guitar player, my mom's a singer and singing teacher, so of course, you know, I had like a paved path in the music business, I would say, but not this level. Like, it was still like a local scene, like right. local scene in Rome and a little bit in Italy, but you know, I think I never actually toured, just like probably played some gigs abroad, you know, around Italy, but touring in an actual bus, you know, first time, and you know, it's cool. I love it.
What's the one thing that maybe growing up when you see touring on a bigger scale, like you're like, I can't wait to do that. And then when you get to actually be, you know, day-to-day touring, what's the one thing maybe you didn't expect?
I would say probably expected everything, you know, like it was like everything was as I expected, I would say, you know, both like pros and cons. Like, I've been following these guys for since forever, you know, like even like interviews and stuff like mm-hmm. that, you know. I'm that much of a music freak. Like, when I like a band, I'm obsessed with a band. I follow every interview right. I can find and stuff like that, you know. So if I was another guy and you were interviewed, the Fear Factory singer, I would probably watch your interview as a fan. You're like, let me check it out.
Right.
So, I made myself an idea of what it's like to be on tour by following, you know, my favorite bands, doing interviews, like digital tour bus and stuff like that, you know. Mm-hmm. It was, it almost felt like I was there, you know. And it's cool because I remember that one of the first Dino told me about tour is that, so you know what I got to do on tour? And I'm like, oh yeah, I did my homework. You know, baby wipes and flip flops.
Got to bring my own pillow.
Yeah. So yeah, but yeah, I would say pretty much everything was pretty much as I expected. Probably more tougher tours like South America was a little bit out of my expectations, like more than expected in terms of how tough it is, because it's tough. You know, you fly every day, you don't always sleep, and now you get to sleep the next day in the afternoon. So, but I would still say, you know, it's still in the range of what I expected, you know. So nice. And I'm loving it, you know. I'm really, at first I was like, oh, let's see if I like it, you know. You never know, you mm-hmm. you may become, you know, the most famous rock star in the world and you end up just not liking it, but I love it. So,
and it's working out. Last one, and then we'll get Dino on here, and I'll finish up. But mm-hmm. The last one for you, man, being, you know, chosen as the singer of Fear Factory, but kind of having to keep it under wraps for so long. Like, how tough was that on you not to just like start telling friends or start like leaking it out, like, you know, a burner account on the internet, like, hey, I hear the new singer invite me, Milo, you know, like anything like that. How tough was that for you to kind of keep it under wraps?
It was kind of tough. I mean, it was tough for enthusiasm perspective. Like, I was so enthusiastic about this new, you know, I wanted to shout it to the world, of course, but I had not to leak it, you know. Mm-hmm. Dino was like, you don't have to leak it, we have to schedule it in the right way, you know, do the announcement in the right way. So of course, you know, it's common sense, you know, you can't just leak it,
right?
So I was just holding it. Of course, the only people that knew about that were my family, my mom, my dad, and my brother, and my best friend, my bandmates, like those very narrow mm-hmm. people in my you know, life. But they were like, you know, I was like, dude, you have to keep your mouth shut, you know. It's so they were really, they're my, you know, closest people, and they were good in not leaking it, you know, and maintain the secret. But the problem was that all those covers that Dino asked me to do were on YouTube, and people started liking them so much that someone started speculating that guy could be the new guy, you know. And so that's where my name started leaking. And so some people already kind of knew, you know, but I think we still did a good job in keeping our mouths shut.
Awesome, man. Well, I think he definitely picked the right guy from everything I've heard so far, man. You sound killer in the band. So
thanks for sitting
down with me, man.
Thank you. Appreciate that very much.
All right.
I want to say definitely thank you for you giving us this opportunity. And for everybody out there who's supported Fear Factory for the last 33 years, we got this huge tour coming up with Machine Head and Orbit Culture. So it's going to be killer. So if you guys want to get tickets, go to fearfactory.com, and there you can get all the tickets, or go to any of our social medias and you'll see all the advertisements and links there. So I hope to see you all out there. And again, thank you for the support.
You know, man, thanks once again for taking some time with us.
Hell yeah. Thank you.
Imprisonment, a bludgeoning force that's under-
Once again, a huge thank you to Dino Cazares for taking some time here. Talk to me, podcast, notfest.com. Make sure you guys rate, review, subscribe, all that good stuff. If you like the episode, make sure to tell a friend. And make sure to check out New Pod, out every other Saturday. And this Saturday, we've got a monster guest, too. So actually, the first like three guests of New Pod this year are all monster guests. So we're going to start out 2024 on a high note. And so just once again, thank you guys for checking out everything that I do. Make sure to rate, review, subscribe, follow, tell some friends, leave comments on the YouTube channel. If you head over to the YouTube channel, leave a comment. Knotfest is watching and is watching those comments, watching those downloads. And I need each and every one of you to head over to the Knotfest YouTube and leave a comment. Say love to me. Keep it going over there. And so for Talk To Me here, knotfest.com, I've been Joshua Toomey, and I will talk to you guys soon.
The Talk To Me podcast, presented by knotfest.com. Follow the show at Talk To Me Talk. Be sure to subscribe, rate the podcast, and leave a review on your favorite podcast app to get the latest from the Talk To Me podcast.